Perhaps some of the husbands and wives after the service will tell me if, now that they are married and of one flesh with each other, whether they feel that they have a life of their own, or whether they say, no, it's us now, not me, but us. And I hope you may say that to me, because I do think that one of the problems today in marriage breakdown is very often that me and my creeps in to a relationship where those words no longer really have any validity. And I began to feel as we were singing that hymn that really I don't like the way it says, take my life, as if, as a Christian, I've got a life. Or take my moments, my days, my hands, my feet, my voice. And I sort of say, Lord, now I'm yours. I'm all yours. So, it's not something I'm holding back from you, Lord. It's your life and mine are one. Now, before we read in Ezekiel, and don't lose the place, please, but I wonder if you'd just like to look at these verses in Ephesians chapter 5, all about marriage. Ephesians 5. I think we'll read in from verse 25, but it's particularly verse 28-29 that we look at. But from verse 25, Ephesians 5, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor, glory, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. She who loves her husband loves herself. For no one ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. It seems that in a proper union of two human beings in marriage, the blessing of the other one is your own blessing, and there is no place for me and mine. Well, let's keep that in mind as we come back to Ezekiel now. Ezekiel chapter 16, and marvel at the love that God is showing here to Jerusalem. This is the city which, at the time of Ezekiel, has really thrown God out. Jerusalem, Mount Zion, the city of God, supposedly, but God has been thrown out. And what God says through Ezekiel here is, to Jerusalem, look, your greatest mistake was when you forgot your origin. Now you may remember in verse 3 that's the first thing God says to them, your origin and your birth are of the land of the Canaanites. Now, here you'll notice God is not speaking about the origin of the world, the universe. He's talking about that origin from which the expression original sin comes. That is, that we who are the descendants of Adam and Eve are born with a flawed heart and will. And although the image of God is still in us, thank God, it is spoiled, and we have a tendency to follow Adam and Eve down the road that they took. Now, God is here saying to Jerusalem in verse 3, your origin and your birth are of the land of the Canaanites. Meaning that they were not, the people of Jerusalem were not originally of the chosen people at all. They were outsiders. They were of the land that, in fact, God was going to have to displace. The people of the Canaanites were all to be displaced to make way for his redeemed people. So Jerusalem has the same beginning as we have when we say, Lord, I was conceived in iniquity. Now, you may find it helpful here to remember what David said in Psalm 51. Psalm 51. And if you're ever tempted to pride as a Christian, to thinking that somehow it's what you've done, that you've become the sort of person you are, look at this. Psalm 51, verse 5, which David pours out of his broken heart after he's committed adultery with Bathsheba and had her husband Uriah murdered on the battlefield to justify his lust. Now, in Psalm 51, verse 5, behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. So that right back, you see, before we'd even taken a breath of our own or done anything or said anything wrong, there is this disablement in the human race that means, in a sense, we're all born with a limp, crippled because of the sin of our first parents. Now, I know people find this something difficult to accept. I'm afraid there is nothing for it but to accept it. Because if we don't, then I think we minimize the problem of sin and evil in the world, and we somehow think that human beings, some start off with a better chance than others, some, you know, have a better home than others, and therefore, perhaps therefore, they're not going to become sinners like others do. But the fact of the matter is that every single one of us is born with this spiritual disability that keeps us from obeying God as we should. Now, Jerusalem in Ezekiel chapter 16 is reminded of her origin. And God then says, because when I first saw you and you were born in such a way that really nobody wanted you, if you look at verse 5, no, I pitied you. And at the end of verse 5, on the day that you were born, you were abhorred. Now, the picture here is of a baby that's born and dumped. Perhaps the baby is handicapped or disfigured in some way, and the parents will not accept responsibility for her. God says, what I did for you, Jerusalem, was as though I came along and found you like this, and I took pity on you. Now you may say to me, I don't like that doctrine of original sin. Well, you're not supposed to like it. It's not telling us anything good about ourselves, and it's not something easy to accept. But, you see, if it was not for that fact about ourselves, we might not as fully appreciate the compassion, the pity of God, who stoops down to take up what nobody else wants. Now I wonder if you're prepared to see yourself like that and say, Lord, well, my family want me, thank God. You maybe all have been born into a loving family. But what if you weren't? What if you'd grown up in a culture that didn't like girl babies and just left them out to die? Or what if you'd grown up in a culture that because there were two born, they dumped some? Or what because parents had already got 10 children and they didn't want any more, yet children kept appearing, they were unwanted and therefore unloved? Maybe then you can understand here why God is saying, my love is for the unwanted one, the unloved one, the unbeautiful one, the rejected one. And that is the quality of God's grace. There is nothing attractive in us to make him say, oh, you know, as perhaps parents eager to adopt a child, they would go and perhaps they would look and see some of these little children in Romania and want to take them into their hearts that are so full of love so often for children, and yet they haven't been blessed with any, but they want to take them. But perhaps they go for the ones that look nicest, that have those eyes that just seem to be filled with promise. But blessed are those parents who are willing to take a child nobody else wants and to bring that child up and to lavish on it the love that has no return in one sense, not initially, but a return later. Because as we know, so many of those who have a handicap, they are wonderfully rich in love. But coming back here to this message that Ezekiel has to speak. From verse 6 and 7, we find here that the first thing God has done is he saved these Jerusalem out of the world. And then he saves her for love. And this we see. You see, he sees her weltering in her blood. Nobody has washed the little body. Nobody has nursed or cared for it, clothed it. It's going to die. And so God speaks the mighty word. Live and grow up. This is the God who wants always to breathe life upon us by his Spirit and to give us a future. And so it was fulfilled, because it says, verse 7, you grew up and became tall and arrived at full maidenhood. It says that she was saved in love, for love. This is what verse 8 goes on to open up to us. Behold, you were at the age for love. Now, is that what God has saved us for when he came to us in Jesus? He saved us for love, so that we would not only love someone in that natural sense in which we may be attracted to somebody of the opposite sex, but we are saved for a whole experience of love in relation to God, in relation to our brothers and sisters in Christ, in relation to our neighbors, in relation even to our enemies. And so you find here that the young woman is described as being unclean, unclaimed, unadorned, unclothed. And God in his love, this husband who is taking to himself this maiden girl, he comes and plights his troth to her. Verse 8. That is where the expression, we don't use it in our Scottish marriage service, but they do south of the border, I think still, where the husband and the wife plight their troth to each other. And it's their way of saying, I am yours to the end of my days. I am yours to the end of my days.
And it's a very solemn and beautiful vow that is taken. And here God is saying, I gave you the model for that in my love for my people Israel, for Jerusalem. I entered into a covenant with you and you became mine. It's important to notice, isn't it, that whereas today people will feel entitled to say to somebody, I want you to be mine, and to do so privately and secretly, that is not God's way. God's way is to do it publicly, so that if we are feeling that somebody is made in heaven for us to be our partner in life, we plight our troth and enter into covenant with them publicly. A covenant has to be witnessed, after all. And then he, she becomes mine. The model for marriage. Now, I think at this point, let's look back to Deuteronomy 7, just to marvel yet again at the wonder that God should love in the way he does. In Deuteronomy 7, there's a lot more love than law in the Old Testament, you know, and even in books like Deuteronomy, there's a tremendous river of love from the heart of God flowing to his people. And here he has to remind them again of just how much he has loved them and why. Now, this may be surprising to us. Deuteronomy 7, verse 6. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession. Now, that word possession, I don't want you to think of this God as the great tyrant master who wants slaves to possess them and own them in that sense. God is saying that in our being his, our willing giving ourselves to him in response to his love, that is the secret of our fulfillment. It doesn't take away any real freedom from us or any real expression of our true selves. Belonging to God is the security that we were created for. So God has said that, I've chosen you to be a people for my own possession. And then he says, out of all the peoples that are on the face of the earth. And the Jews, you see, were tempted repeatedly to think, we must have been special for God to pick us rather than all the other races and tribes on the face of the earth. And then he says this, verse 7. It was not because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love upon you and chose you, for you are the fewest of all peoples. And we might say, Lord, if you wanted to win the world, why didn't you take the race, the tribe that was the largest and would therefore multiply and spread your word over the earth? But he says, no, because I always work in the opposite way to the way you might think. I always take what is small, the thing that is nothing, to do my work. And then in verse 8 he says, this is why I loved you. It is because the Lord loves you. And that's that. And once again, you see, we have to say, Lord, what can we do? We can't question, we can't understand, we must simply accept. And the foolishness that keeps so many people away from Christ and away from the things of God is this unwillingness to accept that God actually loves you, loves me, just as I am. Well, let's come back to Ezekiel 16. We've learned so far that God has saved Jerusalem out of the world to be his. God has saved Jerusalem for love, his love, and her own love. Then we find in verses 9, chapter 16 of Ezekiel, from verse 9 down to verse 14, that God has saved Jerusalem in order that he may put all the riches of his grace upon her. Before God does this, Jerusalem is ungifted, unendowed, unattractive, unappreciated, unknown, unfed, unvalued. It's terribly important, you know. Remember what we said at the beginning. Don't forget your origin as a sinner. An unattractive, unlovely sinner. Here you see God is saying, now, you have nothing that I did not give you. All these things you adorn your life with and make you feel good and give you a sense of worth and make you appreciate yourself and others to appreciate you. God says, where did all that come from? Well, these verses in the description of the bathing, the washing, the anointing, the clothing, the decking with ornaments, the rings, and all the various adornments that are described here are all God's way of saying, anything you have, anything you are, I've given you. Now, you might think that God ought to be saying that kind of thing to us all the time, rubbing it into us. But God is actually quite modest, you know. He's a very modest God. He doesn't boast about all he's done for us. He wants us to appreciate what he's done for us more and more, but the trouble with us is that we don't, and we tend to forget that what we have is his gift. And we look at ourselves and we look in the mirror, we say, oh, I'm good looking. I've got a brain. And we do ourselves up and we make ourselves look even more attractive, we think. And we study hard and we use our brain and we get qualifications. We use our gifts, the gifts we've been given. Sometimes gifts that the world doesn't always appreciate, but which are vital in God's sight. Gifts of relating to people. Gifts of care and compassion and understanding for other people. You don't get a degree in these things. But these are very special gifts of the Spirit. But the trouble is, you see, sometimes we say, oh, I was born that way. And we think these things are ours. Now God goes on from verse 15 in the chapter to remind Jerusalem that she was saved for faithfulness to him. The thing that is so repeatedly obscene about this section is not the mention of all these harlot activities, but the fact that it is Almighty God who has been rejected in favor of some created alternative. You can be sure as a Christian that if you fall away from Jesus, you've fallen down. You've gone into a lesser, inferior lifestyle. And that's why when we become married to Christ through faith, which is becoming a Christian, our lifestyle goes up. Yes, we have married into money when we've married Jesus, haven't we? We have married into riches. We have married into all that's eternally best. And that lifts us. But when we backslide, and when we turn away to the things of this world that so attract us, we're going down. So we are saved for faithfulness. We are saved for stewardship. Because there's something here about what we do with the things God has given us. Perhaps you'd look at verse 17. You took your fair jewels Now God is actually there, almost playing into their hands and letting them think their jewels, their riches are their own. And then he says, you took your fair jewels of my gold and my silver, which I had given you. And because you'd lost sight of me, not because I was absent or hidden, but because you took your eyes off the Holy One, you had to make images of men, because your heart cries out for love, for passion, for fulfillment. You had to make some alternative to satisfy the longing of your heart. And you used what I had given you to prostitute yourself. Similarly, my bread, verse 19. Now, in verse 20, he speaks about the children born in Jerusalem. I wonder who you think your children belong to. And if you are Christian parents, then of course you recognize that the children you've been given, you have born for God. Well, Jerusalem didn't have any concern about the welfare of these children and subjected them to all kinds of abuse. The part of the Old Testament that describes this is in 2 Kings 17, about, as it says here, sacrificing them in the fire. 2 Kings 17. Let's read in from verse 14. 2 Kings 17, verse 14. Here, again, at the similar period of Israel's history as they're declining, falling away from God, the message that comes is this. They would not listen. They were stubborn, as their fathers had been, who did not believe in the Lord their God. They despised his statutes. Statutes are laws, commands, his covenant which he made with their fathers, and the warnings which he gave them. They went after false idols and became false. See, you always become the same as the idol in your life. That thing you idolize, that person, that value system of present-day society that you idolize, you become like it. And here, of course, false idols make the people false, and they followed the nations that were round about them, concerning whom the Lord had commanded them that they should not do like them. And they forsook all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made for themselves molten images of two calves. And that was a way back in the wilderness. And they made an Asherah, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. It was also, of course, under Jeroboam, he who particularly led the people astray. And then this in verse 17, this is the sons and daughters. They burned their sons and their daughters as offerings and used divination and sorcery and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Now, listen. The safest place for children to grow up is in a home where Jesus Christ is loved and where God is honored and his word is believed. That is the safest, happiest place for a child to grow up in. And the difficulty, as we know nowadays, is that so many children are growing up in homes where the love of God is not there, because the people don't want God anymore. And so these children are being subject, aren't they? Day after day we hear this, to all kinds of abuse and neglect and deprivation. And it happened in Israel in this most horrific of ways, that the people who'd been taught where children were to honor father and mother, that their days may be long in the land that God had given them, here, because there was no honouring of God, no honouring of parents, no respecting and loving of children, these children didn't have any time to have long years in the land that God had given them. They were burned as offerings to false gods. And one wonders today, even though it's not done in that vivid, vile way of actually burning the bodies, whether there isn't some equivalent loss of a generation, because children, perhaps through the sad and awful thing of abortion, or perhaps through the way in which they're growing up without any knowledge of God and the love of God in their hearts, they're actually being lost. And one wonders even if children in homes, of church homes, where the children have been lost because, for some reason or other, the parents may have wanted to sacrifice their children on the altar of education, or the altar of progress, or the altar of modernity, or the altar of being contemporary and up with their friends, and all that. Who knows? Dear Lord, may He humble us all and bring us to His feet in need as we face up to the inadequacies of our own lives and our great need of Him. Let's come back then to Ezekiel. The last thing that we're told in these verses is in relation to the other countries that are mentioned, to whom Israel and Judah gave themselves. They wanted to be like Egypt. They wanted to be like the Philistines. They wanted to be like the Assyrians. They wanted to be like the Chaldeans. They entered into trading relationships with them. These were to be their friends. That was the kind of company they really wanted to keep. They thought these people were better off than they were. Now, is there a temptation in you sometimes to say, it's so restrictive being a Christian. You can't do this, you can't do that. Oh, come on. There's nothing more restrictive than the bonds of sin. And the liberty that we are called into in Jesus actually opens up a life of adventure and possibility that you could never have outside of Jesus. Now, the problem for God's people here in the time of Ezekiel was that they looked jealously and enviously at Egypt. As it says there in verse 26, you played the harlot with the Egyptians. They were your partners, your lovers. And then when you'd had enough of them, you looked at the Philistines and you went there. Although it does say, of course, in relation to the daughters of the Philistines, that actually the Philistine girls, or the Philistine culture, was even shocked at the unfaithfulness of Israel. But it does say about Assyria, they went off there. Oh, we'd like to be close to you, Assyrians. Or Chaldeans, end of verse 29. Now, God saves us to go out into the world, doesn't He? To rub shoulders, to be close to other people who don't share our faith, who have different ways of looking at life. Yes. But He sends us into the world, not as part of the world. He saved us out of the world to go into the world again in His name, as an influence for good and for love and for light. So we are saved for witness. Do you remember Abraham, at the very beginning of the story of God's people? The Lord says, He who blesses you, Abram, I will bless. He who curses you, I will curse. And through you and in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Meaning that really God has entrusted to the people who are His the secret that's going to make life better for others. Their blessing is in them knowing us, not our blessing in knowing them. And this is not to put them down and say there's nothing good in people out there. It's simply to say that if you belong to Jesus, and why don't you if you don't? But if you belong to Jesus Christ, you're going into the world with a heart that has been touched by the love of Christ, that takes the worthless, unwanted, unlovely, clothes and enriches our lives, makes us, gives us such a sense of worth and value, and sends us out there as human beings to radiate something of the love of God to these other people. Do you not think, although they wouldn't admit it, deep down inside, perhaps they're longing for us to share something of Christ with them? Maybe that's why in verse 30 God says, how lovesick is your heart. There isn't a human being alive that isn't lovesick, hungry for love. And there's no purer, finer, holier love on earth than can be found in Jesus Christ and among his people. Now that's a very high thing we've to live up to, but you see, that's why we're in the world. Not to go and be like the world, or even worse than the world, but to go out there and serve, as Jesus did when he came among us. And he came among us, remember, and he was born unwanted, barely clothed, laid in a manger. And he grew up to be a man who had nowhere to lay his head. And he went among the people because in his heart was the love of God. And that's the reason why Jesus is such a fine example of a man. Because the love of God is in his heart. The Spirit of God is upon him. And that's why he was able to go out there and not think about me. When did Jesus ever think about himself? He went out among the people and thought of them. And look how many he enriched and changed and healed and delivered. And then lastly, of course, he gave himself. That was the tragedy of Israel, that it wouldn't die to let its light shine in the world. And it took Jesus to be the one whose death released God's love beyond those limited borders into all the world. Now, will you just notice one thing as we close in verse 27? You see, if we know God and know Jesus Christ and do not set him as central and highest in all our thoughts and all our desires, then we are going to find ourselves diminished. Do you see that word in verse 27? God says, after all I gave you, you threw it up, said, I prefer the world. And God says, your life became diminished. Now that's judgment. I believe the church in our time, although God is most graciously giving us a savor again of his love and his grace, I believe we're a diminished force, aren't we, in the land. And we have to trace that diminished force back to some point where we have gone with the world instead of going with God. When we've forsaken the riches he's given us and have preferred to be like the world around us. And now the world is rejecting us. Now the great thing about the gospel is that we can be restored. Personally, and as a people, happened with Israel. They went into Babylon to be restored and rebuilt and cleansed and delivered of the sin of idolatry. My friends, please, let's not undervalue what we've been given by the Lord. Now, some of you, when you form friendships, younger folk, with other Christians, do you say to yourself, oh, this is great. Here's someone that I'm drawn to. We're fond of each other.
Or do you say, Lord, if by your grace you had not caused me to be in this place among these people, I would never have met that person. Now, that's what Israel was doing, you see, when they took God's blessings and they thought they're mine. They forgot their origin. They forgot that it was God who had given them these gifts. So, please, let's come back to him and say, just thank him for absolutely everything you have. And say, Lord, but for you, I too would be unwanted, unloved, unclean, unclaimed, unendowed, unknown, unappreciated, unvalued. Such is his love. And may we go on and on to know more and more of it as we know more and more of him who first loved us with an everlasting love. Amen.